Welcome in to Words with Wallace. I'm your host, Nick Wallace, coming at you later than I'd like to on Wednesday, April 2nd. What's going on, everybody? Just FYI, just really powering through a tummy ache to bring you this podcast here today, so I hope you guys appreciate it. Honestly, I feel like the NBA basketball has gotten much better since the last time that we talked. Last podcast, if you guys missed it, caught you guys up on everything that you missed during the first couple rounds of March Madness, and frankly, it wasn't much. A lot of guys missing games, a lot of teams totally committed to tanking, and while we've had some of that within the past week, we also have a lot of really competitive games, especially in the Western Conference, where you have some teams jockeying for playoff position. A couple games that I believe are outright candidates for games of the year. And so on this podcast today, as you guys can tell by the title of this episode, I am going to be redoing the 2024 NBA draft. I think this has been a really fun time the past couple weeks late into the season. It's really fun to evaluate all the rookies, a lot of them just now getting big minutes for the first time all season long. So we're going to be taking a look at how the draft order would shake out, in my opinion, if we were going to redo the draft today. But before we can get into that, I took another trip down to San Antonio, caught another Spurs doubleheader. Definitely was not anticipating seeing two different Spurs doubleheaders before this season started, but that's kind of how it worked out. So I'll tell you guys about that. And we have a bunch of news and notes that I want to hit on before we get into redoing the 2024 NBA draft. So a lot to get to today. Let's start off with my time in San Antonio. Honestly, the reason I planned this second trip to San Antonio is because I had a second opportunity to play a game on an NBA court. Wish I could tell you guys the experience was a little different from the first time, but again, very humbling. It turns out I am just a church league merchant, a GBC merchant, if you will. Kind of dominant in that league. You know, you catch me on the right night, I'm a problem out there. You bring me onto an NBA court, everything's short, right? I probably shot 1 of 10 in my second trip out playing on the Spurs court. At least this time we got the win. So it was a lot of fun. But yes, very humbling to get up and down an NBA court, at least at my age anyway. Maybe back in the day would have handled it a little bit better. But needless to say, it was still a really cool experience to play on the court on this past Sunday. And before that, the night before, I actually made it down to see the Celtics game. So I want to tell you about seeing the Celtics in person. And on the back half of that doubleheader, I saw the Golden State Warriors play as well. So let's start with a little bit of Celtics talk. Honestly, haven't given the Celtics a ton of attention during the regular season. Definitely have not been the story of the season like they were at this time last year. And frankly, this is kind of like a bad time for me to be talking about the Celtics. They had an awesome stretch the past couple of weeks and then, of course, had a terrible loss at home to the Miami Heat tonight. So for now, I am willing to put that loss to the side. I didn't watch the game in its entirety, but I did see the Celtics looking pretty sluggish, pretty awful Tatum game through and through. But that being said, I'm not taking too much stock in a one-off bad game against Miami when, of course, we were missing guys. I think the Heat are just destined to beat us once every year, no matter how lopsided the matchup may look on paper. But before the Celtics lost to the Heat tonight, they had won 9 in a row. They were 14-1 in their previous 15. I actually just learned something about the Celtics, and shout out my guy Naveed for making me aware of this. The Celtics are actually on track to tie the 15-16 Warriors with the best road record in NBA history if they're able to close out a road back-to-back series against the New York Knicks and the Orlando Magic later next week. Really fascinating stuff that we've been so dominant on the road that our road record is actually far superior to our home record, which, if you guys remember, is obviously the opposite of what the case was this time last year. Not to say that our road record last year was bad, but our home record, like, I think it took us until like February, if I'm not mistaken, to like lose our first game of the year at home. Like, we had a really crazy stretch winning at home, defending our home court for the vast majority of last season. That has not been the case for the Celtics, obviously, again, with them losing at home to the Miami Heat again tonight. But I think the most encouraging thing that I can say about the Celtics, especially after watching them in person, it seems like basically our entire roster is playing some of the best basketball of the entire season. Again, putting tonight to the side, I think Jason Tatum is playing easily the best basketball of his career. What he's doing as a creator and how confident he looks dissecting the defense, really been a point forward for us all year long, is so impressive. His mid-range game is light years ahead of what it was at this time last year. And it just seems like there's so many different ways he can beat you offensively while still being that same rebounding and defensive presence that the Celtics have been used to over the past couple years. Jrue Holiday is playing outstanding, shooting the ball much better than what he did to start the season. Kristaps Porzingis is such an X factor. He was probably the biggest takeaway from watching the Celtics play in person. And frankly, I didn't even see a good Kristaps game. He didn't have it going on the offensive end of the court. But I know the Spurs are a really rough watch right about now, and their offense is pretty abysmal. But the amount of shots that he deterred at the rim, even besides the ones that he blocked in that game that I saw on Saturday, was ridiculous. Like, he's just such a presence out there, and you really feel him on the defensive end of the court, even more than the X factor that he is on offense being such a problem with his efficient post-ups and obviously the ability to space the floor from three. I mean, if we have him healthy, unlike last year, I think that's going to be the big X factor for this team, like it's always been. Luke Kornet coming off the bench, just being such an asset for this Celtics team that has loved leaning into the two big lineup lately. He's been playing easily the best basketball of his career, which is pretty amazing to say that he is such a massive asset for us. I believe he's one of the entire league leaders in net rating. If you take stock in that, Luke Kornet would be the best player on the Boston Celtics. And then going back to obviously some more core lineup fixtures, we have Derek White, who's been amazing for the Celtics all season long. And really, if I were to pick a worry with anybody on the Boston Celtics right now, I'd have to say Jaylen Brown. Not that I don't love how he's been playing as of late. It hasn't been his best basketball, but he's been kind of in and out of the lineup with a knee injury, and it still doesn't look like he's quite 100%. And so he's really the only person on the team that's not playing the best basketball of the season. So I think Jaylen's health is something worth monitoring for Celtics fans during the final games of the season. Hopefully we see him have a couple big games before the end of the regular season just so he's in a good rhythm and at 100% health as we head into the playoffs. Of course, I'd be remiss to not mention Al Horford, how amazing he's been. Not just shooting the ball, but on the defensive end, his ability to switch onto the perimeter and still move his feet just as well as he could like 10 years ago is ridiculous. So I'm feeling really confident about the Celtics. Again, putting this loss to Miami to the side, I feel really good about the team. And when I watched them in San Antonio, I just saw a group that was extremely locked in. They went on to beat Memphis the following night and have another great winning clutch time without Jaylen Brown. So all things considered, really excited as a Celtics fan right about now, and loved having the opportunity to watch them play in person in San Antonio. Moving on to the back end of the back-to-back set that I saw in person, this was the Warriors coming to town to face the Spurs. This one was a really brutal watch. The game was basically over by the end of the first quarter. The Warriors got up by like 15 points, and you could just kind of tell that it was going to be a blowout. Like, the Spurs really didn't have any second effort left in them. And by the time of the end of the third quarter rolled around, the Warriors had already scored like 115 points or something like that. I think they finished the game winning by like north of 40. Steph, I think, only played like about 20 minutes on the night because they simply didn't need him. But that being said, my biggest takeaway just in the experience of going to the game, seeing Steph Curry play in person for the second time ever, this one I definitely enjoyed the experience a little bit more. The first time I saw him play last year, I had like a work thing going on. Didn't have the opportunity to get to the game early and watch him warm up and stay as locked in during the game as I would have liked to. That being said, this time around, got to the arena super early, saw all the Curry jerseys lining up north of 2 hours before tip-off. Like, again, watching Steph warm up is like a phenomenon at this point in time. So the amount of Curry jerseys that you saw lining up outside of the Spurs arena for a game that wasn't even close to being sold out, mind you, was insane. You know, when Steph did obviously come out of the tunnel and start warming up, there was a bigger pop than anybody on the Spurs at this point in time. Same thing when he scored during the game. Like, the crowd reception was just unlike anything I've ever seen for a road team and really any basketball game I've been to throughout my entire life. And again, this wasn't a close game. It wasn't a competitive game. It wasn't a particularly dominant Steph game. But the love for that guy in San Antonio, of all places, really stood out to me. And just like some little things that you notice when you're not watching the game on TV, you can kind of see what's happening off the ball a little bit easier, in my opinion. And I just was more impressed with the defense that Steph has to face every single night, right? Like, dudes being physical with him. Castle was the main guy on San Antonio with the Steph Curry assignment. How physical he's being with Steph Curry, like 45 feet from the basket, picking him up full court, having to deny him the ball. The whole nine yards, like what Steph literally faces on a routine basis, and he's still able to get to, you know, 24, 25, 26 points a game easily, right? And Steph post All-Star break, post Jimmy Butler trade, is a completely different guy than the one we saw to start the season. So I think Steph's in his final form. I think that much was on display with of course, the most recent game that Steph Curry had. Of course, the following game after I see Steph Curry put up like a 13-point performance in 20 minutes, he goes out and drops 52 and having arguably the best game of his entire career against the Memphis Grizzlies. So I really enjoyed watching Steph. It's even more amazing to see him in person and to see what he has to deal with on a night-to-night basis, given how small he is, right? He looks even smaller in person than what you see on TV, and really enjoyed the opportunity to watch him play, even though the game itself, Spurs versus Warriors, was not all that entertaining. Keeping it moving to a couple other games that I wanted to highlight within the past week. I know this one's old news at this point, and you guys have probably already seen the clips, but I gotta say, the best 15 seconds of basketball that I saw all year long, bar none, took place last Thursday in a game between the Lakers and the Bulls. Just in case you guys missed it, to give you a sense of the circumstance, the Lakers were up 5 with 12 seconds left in the game, and then the following plays took place, right? You have a Patrick Williams 3 off an ATO with 10 seconds left. Then immediately, LeBron has one of the worst passes of his career, turns it over to Josh Giddey, kicks it out to Kobe White. He drills a 3 with 6 seconds left. So the Lakers go from being up 5 to down 1. Then the Lakers get the ball back. Austin Reeves, who was unbelievable this entire game, gets a really clutch layup to go with 3 seconds left in the game. And immediately, Chicago has no timeouts left. They inbound the ball to Josh Giddey, and he puts up a half-court shot, nails it at the buzzer to win the game. And if you somehow hadn't seen that clip, I encourage you guys to look it up. It was incredible. The Chicago Bulls crowd was losing their mind. Naturally, they were experiencing probably one of their biggest sellout nights of the season because the Lakers were in town. So it was awesome that the fans got such an exciting end to that one. And then most recently, the game that we had last night between the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Denver Nuggets. All of the matchups between these two teams this regular season have been amazing, but last night definitely takes the cake. Even though both teams were super shorthanded in this one being played in Denver, Minnesota was missing Dante DiVincenzo and Naz Reid, while Denver was even more shorthanded, missing Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. This is one that I had like on in the background as I was doing some prep for this podcast, was certainly not planning on staying up to the very end of the game. And then I'm watching the game. I'm like, man, this is pretty entertaining. There's 5 minutes left. All of a sudden, the game goes to overtime. I'm like, crap, I'm sucked in for another 5 minutes. That overtime's amazing. It goes into double overtime. By this point, it's like an extra 30 minutes than what I had originally bargained for, so I'm like exhausted today. But it was well worth it. I mean, the game was incredible. It came all the way down to the wire. Jokic finished the game with 61 points, 10 rebounds, and 10 assists in a whopping 53 minutes. Jokic basically played an hour of NBA basketball last night and dominated the entire time. He did not exit the game from halfway through the second quarter onwards. So he literally played 40 straight minutes of basketball to close the game. On the other side of the ball, you had Anthony Edwards with an incredible game in his own right, 34, 10, and 8. And again, I don't want to focus on the stars too much. I don't need to go play-by-play through this entire game because really all the role players in this game were amazing. But a special mention goes out to Aaron Gordon because he was incredible as Jokic's right-hand man in this one. He was shooting the three ball with such confidence. He had a ton of clutch threes both at the end of regulation and throughout the overtime periods as well. And so it was really heartbreaking loss for Denver. I mean, you guys have, again, probably seen this by now. But with basically 17 seconds left in the game, Denver was up by 1. Minnesota has the ball. They were sending double teams at Anthony Edwards all throughout the close of the game. And frankly, Ant was kind of hit or miss with how he read those. I know that's definitely a challenge for a young player in the NBA who's not used to being double teamed for that much at this point in time. But it looked like the Wolves had a play where they were planning on having Ant handle the double team by having Randall make a hard cut to the basket. It looked like he hesitated. And then right when he went to make the cut, Ant threw the ball away. So there's 17 seconds left. The Nuggets are storming down the court. They're up 1. Westbrook has the ball and ends up smoking a layup, like a wide open layup with what, roughly like 11 seconds left in the game at that point in time. Immediately, Minnesota collects the rebound, goes up the court. They don't have any timeouts. Ant makes a great read, driving to the basket, kicks it in the corner to Nikhil Alexander-Walker. And Westbrook has to make a really difficult closeout, closes out super hard, and ends up fouling Nikhil Alexander-Walker as time expires, giving him an opportunity to knock down up to 3 free throws, basically with 0 seconds left on the clock at that point, and he makes the first 2 shots. Minnesota goes up by 1, and the game effectively ends. And so just a brutal end of the game for Russell Westbrook, having him make the decision to take the layup in the first place, which, honestly, I think that the decision to take the layup in that situation is pretty defensible given how open he was, right? You could have made the argument with them being up 1 with the ball that he should have just, you know, basically done like a Nash dribble the ball out, see how much time he can waste, or maybe pass it to a better free throw shooter, whatever that looks like. Sure, in hindsight, you definitely would have preferred him do that, but he was wide open for a layup. Like, he should have just simply made the layup, but he didn't. And of course, I think the most damning thing that Westbrook did on that play besides smoking the layup was just kind of, he seemed to just be stunned that he missed it, and it took him like an extra second to like sprint back into the play where Minnesota had an advantage and was charging up the court, trying to get a bucket to win the game. And it felt like if he had gotten back a little bit quicker, maybe he wouldn't have had to make such a hard closeout to Nikhil Alexander-Walker in the first place. I can't sit here and say that I loved the call. It didn't feel like a super obvious 3-point foul, but with how the officiating has been around three-point shooters all year long, I'm not surprised that it was called. And so just a heartbreaking loss for the Denver Nuggets to lose that one at home, to put that many miles on Jokic, where, again, he played for a full hour, had just an absolute masterclass that I think if Denver wins, like, I don't want to be too dramatic here, like, I think that could have actually swung the MVP odds even more. I'm sure Jokic gained some momentum by putting up 61, 10, and 10 last night, even in a loss. Like, the shots he was hitting and how unstoppable he was, especially once Gobert fouled out, like, he could do no wrong scoring all those awkward, you know, mid-range shots in the painted area like he's so talented with. He was just on one all night long. And so it's pretty incredible that Minnesota was able to come out with the win last night. And I'm just praying that we get this in the playoffs one way or another, right? Doesn't matter who's going to be out there for either team. It seems like we are destined to get a 7-game series. I don't care if we get it in round one, round two, even the Western Conference Finals. I'd be thrilled to get any sort of Minnesota-Denver come this postseason. And finally, let's just hit on a couple other news and notes before we get into redoing the 2024 NBA draft. A lot of these pertaining to injuries right about now and some not great news coming out of Milwaukee. Dame Lillard at this point is likely going to be out for the season. Again, really scary health issue here. He has deep vein thrombosis of his calf. And so if you guys remember, this is basically the same condition that Victor Wembanyama is suffering from. He had it in his shoulder. Damian Lillard has this blood clot issue in his calf. Really scary, obviously fortunate for Damian Lillard that they were able to catch this, but the timing is obviously far from ideal with the Bucks trying to prepare for a playoff run. It just seems like the luck for Giannis and the Bucks the past couple years has been ridiculous. It's been several years at this point in time. I think a full 3 years since the Bucks have been fully healthy going into the postseason, which is wild to think about. The Bucks are cooked at this point in time. I would be absolutely shocked, no matter who they draw in the first round, that they would clutch out any sort of playoff series win, no matter how amazing Giannis is. The supporting cast just isn't there right now, especially without Damian Lillard. They are so shorthanded on the offensive end of the court. I just think it's going to be really hard for Milwaukee to do anything, and this is going to make it very interesting for Giannis this offseason, right? Maybe he stays, maybe he goes, but I hate to get too far into that right now at this point in the season. We have more important things to talk about, but the reality is, for any Bucks fans listening to this, get used to a lot of Giannis in the trade machine. If the Bucks aren't even able to make a run and have some momentum heading into next year, I just find it really unlikely that next year is going to be the year that they turn it around as a team, with their already very old core getting even older heading into next season. So again, terrible news coming out of Milwaukee right there. More unfortunate news coming out of Phoenix as well. Kevin Durant actually sprained his ankle on Sunday in a game against the Houston Rockets, in which they were getting absolutely trounced. They were down by 35 points at the time of the injury, even though it was only the third quarter. Durant made a move going to the hoop on Jabari Smith, just came down on Jabari's foot and rolled it pretty bad. They're saying that Durant's going to be reevaluated in 1 week, but honestly, it looked like a pretty bad sprain. At that point, there's only a couple games left in the season. I expect Kevin Durant to play if he can. I mean, that's just the type of guy that he is. And especially with how the season has gone, he has a lot to prove. So maybe he comes back for the final few regular season games. Maybe Phoenix can somehow hang in the playoff picture just long enough where Durant comes back for a play-in game. But needless to say, I mean, that is almost certainly the kill shot for the Phoenix Suns. I would be pretty surprised if they end up hanging on to that playoff spot, because the only positive thing that they have going for them right now is the Kings have been basically just as bad as the Suns lately. I believe they're like 1-7 in their last 8 games. So the Kings are spiraling as well. Meanwhile, we have another team in the Western Conference play-in race that's going in the opposite direction at this point in time. Anthony Davis is back playing games for the Dallas Mavericks. I mentioned it on my last podcast. I think I recorded on the night he was scheduled to make his debut, ended up making it later that night. And I absolutely love this for Anthony Davis. I think there's a lot of Mavericks fans, both in my life and just in general, that I've seen that do not want Anthony Davis coming back to the team this season, really just because they've had the season from hell. They have nothing to play for. They're still dealing with a ton of other injuries. Obviously, no Kyrie being the headline there. So it's pretty unrealistic that Dallas is able to make any noise in the postseason. But Anthony Davis has a lot to prove, right? If you're a professional athlete, you kind of feel like your name was dragged through the mud, people calling the Luka trade the worst trade ever, which certainly might end up being the case. But that being said, Anthony Davis is certainly not a scrub. He probably believes he's a better player than Luka Doncic. He certainly has a lot to prove to the fans that have inherited Anthony Davis in Dallas. So I love that he's making the decision to play regardless of what people probably within his own front office are telling him to do. And frankly, the Mavs have been really good with Anthony Davis. This, you know, they didn't only get him back. They've also had PJ Washington back for a couple weeks. I believe Derek Lively actually made his return tonight as well. And the Mavericks, record-wise, with Anthony Davis so far, small sample size, but they're 5-1. And including tonight, they actually had a really clutch win. I watched the final few minutes in which Anthony Davis had 34, 15, and 5 blocks against the Atlanta Hawks. Not only that, he closed out the game incredibly for the Mavericks. The game was tied with a few seconds left. He hit a runner in the lane over Okongwu to take the lead. And then on the final possession of the game, gets switched on to Trae Young like 30 feet from the basket and plays incredible defense on Trae Young in the closing seconds, forces up a tough shot, and Dallas is able to get the win. So at this point in time, I am fully expecting the Dallas Mavericks to be in either the 9 or the 10 spot. And then it's really just a death race between the Kings and the Suns to see who can slide into that final 10 spot. But good for Dallas Mavericks fans to have something to root for. If they somehow win in advance from the play-in tournament and get the Oklahoma City Thunder in the first round, I'm not saying that they're going to give the Thunder a scare, but I know that'd be fun playing off the matchup that we saw last year. Obviously, geographically, Oklahoma City is probably the closest team to us here in Dallas at this point in time. So finally, some good news coming out of Dallas. It's probably not going to mean much once the playoffs actually start. But don't be surprised if Dallas is able to make some noise coming out of the play-in tournament with the return of Anthony Davis. And then the final piece of news that I want to talk about before we just take a quick look at the Western Conference standings and redo the 2024 NBA draft. We had some pretty wild news coming out of Memphis late last week. The Memphis Grizzlies decided to move on from head coach Taylor Jenkins. They replaced him with an internal candidate, Thomas Lasalo. He's a Swedish guy, and frankly, he is the most Swedish-looking man I've ever seen in my life. Like, the blonde hair, comb over, beard combo is really great. I wish I could pull that off myself. But that being said, this was super shocking when it happened, with Memphis only having 9 games left in the season. And I believe at the time that they moved on from Jenkins, I think that the Grizzlies were up at like the 5 or the 6th seed in the Western Conference. They're still at the 6th seed now. And granted, the Grizzlies are going through a really tough stretch, but I feel like all of their recent slide can be attributed mainly to injuries, right? I mean, starting off with Ja Morant, I've been saying it all year long. I've been super low on Memphis. Like, Ja, even when he plays, he's not the same guy that we saw a couple years ago. The 3-ball is not falling at a consistent clip. The turnovers are up there. Just seems like his decision-making and ability to get to his spot is slightly reduced than what we've seen in the past. Yes, he's had some amazing games throughout this year, but he's also had some really big duds and some big spots. And again, he really only plays like 3 out of every 4 or 3 out of every 5 games. That's been the case all year long. You have Jaren Jackson Jr., who's been the best player for the Grizzlies for most of this season, had a pretty significant ankle injury a couple weeks back. And ever since then, ever since he's returned, he's been a bit slowed down, just not quite as productive. He also very frequently gets into foul trouble, which definitely hurts the team even more so on the defensive end of the court. And then they had some bad news coming out with other injuries, right? They lost Brandon Clark for the season about a week and a half ago at this point in time, who was a really great bench player for them, a really high energy backup big, which could give them a nice pivot option to turn to if it wasn't a Zach Edey game, right? And frankly, like, Memphis has so many guys, like, they've done such an amazing job at drafting that they almost have too many guys in their rotation, right? It's like, what strings do you pull? What buttons do you press on a night-to-night basis? You got young players like GG Jackson, who were incredible for Memphis last year, and Vince Williams, who missed huge chunks of the season, and then suddenly they're back in the fold. They're expecting to play minutes. You have veterans like Luke Kennard, who have been productive at times, and frankly, there's just really too many guys to fit into a consistent rotation. So it's, all that being said, it's really like not a fun team to coach, at least from the outside looking in. And you decide to move on from your head coach after a relatively successful season with just 9 games left. Like, whatever you think of Taylor Jenkins, whatever you think of the interim guy that you have in place, I just find it very hard to believe that they wouldn't be better off and more likely to make an upset in the first round with Taylor Jenkins continuing to lead the ship throughout the postseason. Like, when the news first happened, I thought there must have been some sort of, like, off-the-court scandal that I didn't know about because, again, everything we just talked about, it seemed justified. But enough time has passed since we got that news that I don't think there's, like, a big bomb or, you know, another shoe to drop on this news where we're suddenly this firing is going to make a lot of sense. And so, hopefully for Taylor Jenkins' sake, like, if I were him, I'd be so upset. Like, suddenly it's, like, a really awkward time to be fired, so it just kind of makes you question what's going on with Taylor Jenkins, and hopefully that doesn't hurt his chances to land another head coaching job by, like, the nature and the timing by which he was fired. So, just really weird stuff coming out of Memphis. Like, I could have told you that the vibes were bad, and I could have told you I liked them less than really any other team that is guaranteed to be in the Western Conference playoffs. Like, I'm not taking them to beat anybody. I really haven't all year long. But now it's like, that's, again, another kill shot for a team in the Western Conference. I would be so shocked, no matter who Memphis draws in the first round, no matter what injury luck, even if it breaks their way, I'd be shocked if they make any sort of noise in the playoffs this year. And so, again, at the time of recording, just to take a quick look at the Western standings as of right now, again, obviously OKC has locked up the one seed. Right now, Houston, despite a tough loss to the Lakers the other night as well, they're still pretty comfortably in that second seed. They're like three games ahead of Denver. Then you have Los Angeles after that, Golden State after that, Memphis, Minnesota, Clippers, Mavericks, and Kings, with the Suns on the outside looking in, obviously playing without Kevin Durant the next couple of weeks. So I think the Western Conference playoffs, again, I've been saying it for several weeks on this podcast, the standings, how it all shakes out is the most interesting storyline with a few weeks left in the season. And if everything were to stay as it is, you're looking at the Rockets and the Timberwolves matching up in the first round. That would be incredible. They've had some real battles all season long. You could have Golden State and the Lakers playing in round one, which would just make the league happier than what they've been with any other first round matchup probably in history. Getting Steph versus LeBron, getting Luka and Jimmy Butler in the mix as well. Like, it's going to be awesome. So just pay close attention to these Western Conference standings as we close out the final week of the season. Let's move on to redoing the 2024 NBA draft. Now, this is an exercise I did last year. And as I mentioned on my last podcast, I think this was probably like one of the worst segments or like worst takes that I've ever had in the 2 years of doing this podcast. Like, it was just so horribly wrong. Like, it's amazing how bad that list, that redo of the 2023 NBA draft had aged, and it's only been a year since I recorded that. Like, I think I had like Keontae George going to three, who, again, fun little player there in Utah, but I clearly took way too much stock into his stats on the meaningless Jazz at that point in time. And he's really not an efficient player, has a lot of work to figure out, and certainly have no idea how his game will translate to winning basketball if he ever gets that opportunity to get out of Utah or Utah improves or whatever. I also think I had Jaime Jaquez in the top five, who is now getting like DNPs on the regular for the Miami Heat, which I'll admit that one, I'll give myself some credit. Like, he started the season red hot last year. Again, 4-year player in college, comes into the league very ready to go. Physically, it all checks out. So I will admit that his fall off was like pretty unexpected, but not that crazy when you're talking about like an older prospect and how well those guys end up doing over the span of their careers. And so, yeah, this one's probably going to age nearly just as bad as last year's did, but we're going to give it a shot anyways. I don't think this year is as an exciting draft class as what we had in 2023, obviously, but I still think this exercise will be a lot of fun. So I'll try to move through this one relatively quickly because I know these aren't like the biggest names in the world, but starting off with the number one overall pick, which if you guys remember to last June, this was a pick made by the Atlanta Hawks. They went with Zachary Risache. And I think if they were to redo the 2024 NBA draft, I would go with Stephon Castle at the first overall pick. I feel like he's been the best rookie really all season long. This was a really tough decision, I should probably add, but I feel like immediately being a really impactful two-way player, just to give you an idea of the stats that he's been putting up for a pretty bad Spurs team, averaging 14 points a game, 3 rebounds, 4 assists, shooting 42% from the field. And honestly, the three-point percentage was much lower than what I expected going into this exercise. He's only shooting just under 29% from three, so really not great there. But I think the jump shot looks good. The way he gets into his offense is really impressive. I love like how explosive of an athlete he is. And then you combine that with the fact that he has this like incredible deceleration move where once he gets guys on his hip, he can just like stop on a dime, and the amount of flybys that he gets are crazy. Like, again, I've seen the Spurs play in person 4 times now this year, and I feel like at least once a game he gets somebody flying by with that exact move. And again, with how impressive he is on defense, he's already the Spurs' best perimeter defender at this point in time, in my opinion. I just think he's a pretty surefire thing at 6'6", his athleticism, the way it's all going to translate. I would give Castle the slight edge at the number one overall pick. Moving on to the second pick in the draft, originally this went to the Washington Wizards, and they selected Alex Sarr. In this exercise, I'm going to go with Zachary Risache at the number two overall pick. Risache has had an incredible past couple of weeks. He actually just had like a 36-point game against the Milwaukee Bucks within the past week or so, and I watched the highlights back of that. Like, all of the buckets that he got were on like a total of 2 dribbles. Like, how dynamic he looks in catch-and-shoot situations, the way he can, you know, run the floor, fill the lane, catch lobs, like all the athleticism is there. And at his size, being at least 6'8", honestly, he looks more like 6'9", 6'10" when you actually watch the guy play and how fluid everything looks. Like, I think Risache is going to be awesome. He's been very quietly been super impressive for the Hawks all year long, starting at that wing spot. He's averaging 12 points a game, 4 rebounds, just over 1 assist, but he's shooting 45% from the field and 35% from deep. So I really think the future is bright for Reece Hachette. We haven't seen him do a lot of on-ball creating. I mean, playing alongside Trae Young, you wouldn't really expect that. So I'll be interested to see how that develops over the next couple years. But I think for sure that that's not going to be a bust. That's not going to be looked at as like a pick that will haunt Atlanta, which is kind of impressive, right? Because there was not a clear-cut number one overall prospect in this draft. And so I think they mostly got things right by going with Reece Hachette. Moving on to the third pick in the draft. Originally, this pick went to the Houston Rockets and Reed Sheppard. I should have mentioned this at the top, but I'm not doing this based on team need. Like, oh, well, what would the Rockets do if they were in a situation? I'm just going with like best available player at each draft slot. I feel like if we were to redo this draft, you'd have to go with Alex Sarr at this third overall pick. It's been an up and down year for Sarr, right? Playing on like a really abysmal Wizards team. He's been thrust into a big minute role right away. And it was like, early in the season, they still had Valanciunas, and like the plus-minus numbers with Valanciunas out there compared to Alex Sarr like weren't even close, and he was kind of all over the place, especially on the offensive end of the court. But defensively, he flashed right away. He's 7 feet tall. He has incredible instincts in the defensive end of the court. Immediately, he was blocking shots, getting steals, and the offense has come along as the year has gone on as well. On the season, again, playing for a meaningless Washington team, so these stats are pretty inflated. He's averaging 13 points a game, nearly 7 rebounds a game, 2 assists. Only shooting 40% from the field and 32% from three, but I do know that that three-point percentage has climbed significantly in the past couple weeks. The jump shot looks fluid. It looks like he's ultimately going to be a strong, like, stretch five option, right? We think back to how Wemby looked, how awkward he was for shooting the three ball. Like, some of the same principles apply to Alex Sarr here, but I just feel like athletically, how he checks out, the size, the defense, like, it's all going to come together for him being a really valuable two-way player. And originally, he was one of the top prospects heading into this draft, so I don't think he falls outside of the top three. Moving on to the fourth pick in the draft. Originally, this was made by the Spurs, and they went with Castle in this slot. In this exercise, I'm going to have Matas Buzelis of the Chicago Bulls being drafted fourth overall. Not sure how he fell so far in the actual draft, given his size and athleticism. I know we probably all saw him put up a pretty terrible performance in the dunk contest, but the dude's 6'10", a really explosive athlete. The three ball's coming together as well, and he just started playing really consistent minutes for the Chicago Bulls like the past like month or so. To start the year, they were going with Patrick Williams. Buzelis has been in the starting lineup for a while now, and everything I've seen from Buzelis looks really good. Like, his handle really stands out for a dude that's 6'10". You guys might have seen the clip of him like shaking Luka out of his shoes on the baseline like a couple weeks ago, but it's basically bullying in any situation with Luka on defense. But I was still really impressed with what I saw from Buzelis on that play. He's had a few different 30-point games and 3-point shots coming along on the season. He's averaging just 8 points a game, 3 rebounds and 1 assist, but again, shooting almost 45% from the field, shooting almost 35% from three. I just think that athletically, for what he can do and the way he can handle the rock at his size, just like Reece Hachette, it's kind of a no-brainer. I think that guy has to be a top-4 pick in a redraft. Moving on to the fifth pick in the 2024 NBA draft. Originally, this was a pick that belonged to the Pistons. They went with Ron Holland, but in this exercise, I'm going to go with Khalil Ware of the Miami Heat. This guy flashed early in the season for the Miami Heat, and he's been the starting center, pushing Bam Adebayo over to the power forward position for several months now. And what he can do at his size is scary, right? I'm actually looking at his basketball reference page now, and he's listed at 7 feet. There's no way he's only 7 feet tall. He's got to be at least 7'2", especially if you've watched any Miami Heat games this year. Like, this guy is massive, and how fluid of an athlete that he is for a guy his size. I know I've said that a few times with Buzelis and Reece Hachette and even Alex Sarr as well, but Khalil Ware is significantly bigger than all the guys we just talked about. Again, standing at 7'2", really fluid looking jump shot, even though he's only shooting 32% from three. He was taking a lot more threes when he first entered the starting lineup for the Miami Heat. He's scaled back a little bit on that lately, but he's an incredible rim protector. He's averaging 9 points, 7 rebounds, 1 assist, and I believe he's averaging at least a block and a steal a game as well. And again, it's just really an eye test thing with Khalil Ware. The way he moves at his size, it doesn't look like he's going to be like a Klingon or an Edie where you're really going to be able to expose him on the perimeter because how quick he is on his feet, and then his recovery, his length, all that stuff around the rim, what he does to affect other teams' offense in the paint. Like, I just think this guy is checking every box. He's going to have the opportunity to be coached by Eric Spoelstra, learn alongside Bam Adebayo. Like, I really do think this guy's going to be a problem, and I don't think there's any way you could have him outside the top five in a redraft. Rounding out like the true top tier of guys in this draft at the sixth overall pick, this originally went to the Charlotte Hornets. They drafted Tijon Saloon. I believe I'm pronouncing that right. Haven't loved what I've seen from the Saloon this year. But in this redraft exercise, I'm going to go with Jared McCain of the Philadelphia 76ers. You guys probably remember early in the season, McCain was like incredible for the Sixers right off the gate. Really, the only two good things that have happened to the Sixers all year long were Jared McCain's performance early in the season and Quentin Grimes' performance late in the season. And it's kind of funny when you look at Jared McCain's stats, obviously small sample size, only played in 23 games and had the luxury of being thrust into a major role right away for a really needy Sixers team with how banged up they've been all year long. But his stats jump out: 15 points a game, 2 rebounds, 3 assists, shooting 46% from the field and a whopping 38% from deep. Like, with the way that that guy can move, plays very similar, ironically, to his teammate and Tyrese Maxey, and how efficient he is shooting the ball from three. I mean, he was a really impressive prospect coming out of Duke. He fell more in the draft than what people thought. If you can stand, like, the personality thing off the court, which, again, it's all harmless, it's just certainly not my cup of tea, you really can't deny what we've seen from Jared McCain so far. Now, again, the stats are inflated. He was able to step in and immediately take, like, 20 shots a game, all that stuff, but I think what we saw from him is really impressive, and it'd be interesting to see what the rest of his rookie year could have looked like if he stayed healthy, but I expect him to be back and in a major role for the Philadelphia 76ers next year. And once we fall to pick number 7 here, this is when, again, I think that top tier of prospects kind of ends, and you can definitely pick your own adventure with this exercise. We are going to only be going through the lottery here, so we have about 7 picks left. At the number 7 spot, originally, that this pick went to the Trailblazers, they took Klingon here. And this exercise, at number 7 overall, I'm going to go with Ron Holland of the Detroit Pistons. Made some headlines within the past week because he was in a massive scuffle against the Minnesota Timberwolves the other night. He got tied up with Naz Reid, was getting into it with Dante DiVincenzo. The fight, so to speak, kind of bled over into the first couple rows in the Target Center there. And this guy plays with an edge. It's really not surprising to see that this guy got in a scuffle because he plays so hard on both ends of the court. And this dude is just like a slasher, man. Like, the jump shot is really questionable at this point in time, but he had like a 26-point game the other night and was so impressive if you watch the highlights back. Like, if he catches the ball with any sort of momentum going to the rim at 6'8", like, he's getting the rim, right? So physical with the way he's attacking the hoop. The handle looks really tight. It's really just a question of how much you think that jump shot will develop and how you think his role will look in expanded minutes. Like, he's been a really consistent second unit guy for the Pistons all year long, but with the emergence of Ausar Thompson, with how surprisingly good the Pistons have been, they certainly haven't needed him to start right away. On the year, he's only averaging about 7 points a game, 3 rebounds, 1 assist, shooting 48% from the field, which is pretty good, especially considering he's only shooting 23% from 3. I really do like what I've seen from Ron Holland, and the athleticism, the physicality attacking the hoop keeps him in the top 7 in this exercise. Moving on to the 8th pick in the draft, last year it was the Spurs pick. They traded to the Timberwolves and they went with Rob Dillingham. In this exercise, I'm actually having them go with a different Kentucky guy, and this is where I have Reed Sheppard, right? This was my pick early on for Rookie of the Year. Obviously, this aged terribly. The guy has been in and out of the G League, certainly cannot carve out any sort of consistent role on a really competitive Rockets team. In his defense, right, obviously they are currently 2nd in the Western Conference, but I can't lie, it's been a huge disappointment for Reed Sheppard that at the very least, his shooting at Kentucky has not translated, at least not yet. He's only appeared in 46 games. He's only averaging 4 points a game in those appearances. 1 rebound, 1 assist, only 34% from the field and about 29% from 3. So very disappointing for Reed Sheppard, but I do have to preface this by saying, like, small guards in year 1, it's really tough to make that leap to the NBA. I do expect that Reed Sheppard is going to prove himself to at least be a valuable bench piece moving forward. The pedigree for this guy to be taken 3rd overall, to be sneaky, a much better defensive prospect than what people realize, even standing at only like 6'2", 6'3". I think Reed Sheppard would be just fine. I think it'd be really fascinating to see him go to one of those bottom barrel teams like a New Orleans or a Utah or a Philadelphia. And I think that his season would be completely different. I think he actually could be in the Rookie of the Year race if he was given that expanded role. So just because of the pedigree and how I felt about him as a prospect, although I didn't watch much Kentucky, I was really impressed with what I saw. I can't have Reed Sheppard dropping outside of the top 8. Moving on to the number 9 spot in the 2024 NBA draft. This was originally the Grizzlies pick. They went with Zach Edey. In this exercise, at number 9, I'm going to go with Jalen Wells. This was a guy that was ultimately picked in the 2nd round for the Memphis Grizzlies, but popped right away for Memphis. He's been like the starting three man for the Grizzlies all year long, immediately stepping in, being productive as a solid two-way player, averaging about 11 points per game, 3 rebounds, 2 assists, 43% from the field, and 36% from deep. Jalen Wells has been the Grizzlies' on-ball defender for the vast majority of perimeter players that the Grizzlies have faced all year long. Like, they play the Thunder, he's guarding Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. They play the Warriors, he's guarding Steph Curry. With his size, for what he's done on, I know we just talked about how Memphis is falling apart, but they've been a winning basketball team all year long, and he's been a major contributor. I think for that reason alone, you have to have him in like the top 9 picks like I did here in this exercise. Obviously, I do think there's probably like a ceiling to him, right? He was a second round prospect for a reason. Who knows what he'll end up turning into on the offensive end of the court outside of his ability to shoot the three. Will he have some on-ball creation? He's really been asked to do none of that in Memphis as of right now, but you have to tip the cap to the Grizzlies finding a 6'7" guy that can play defense and shoot the three ball at a high level in his rookie season. And the final few picks of the exercise here at pick number 10, originally this went to the Utah Jazz. They drafted Cody Williams in this spot, but I'm going to have the Jazz at the number 10 pick with Dalton Knecht. Obviously, again, another guy that was a 4-year player in college, flashed right away for the Lakers, got traded, trade got undone. His minutes have been up and down since the trade deadline for the Los Angeles Lakers. But one thing is for certain, Dalton Knecht can immediately come off the bench and shoot and score the ball at a really high level. He's averaging 9 points a game, 3 rebounds, 1 assist, 46% from the field, and 37% from three. You know what Dalton Knecht's going to be. He immediately steps in, he fills a role, shoots the ball at a high clip. There's not much more to be said. I think he deserves to be taken in the top 10 with what we've seen from Knecht this rookie season. Now, once we get to pick 11, you're really grasping at straws. I think there's a lot of different ways you can go with the final few picks here. At number 11, in real life, this pick went to the Bulls. This was a steal where they got Matas Buzelis. In this exercise, I'm going to have the Bulls taking Rob Dillingham at pick number 11. Again, same principles. Everything I just said for Reed Sheppard, you can basically apply to Rob Dillingham. Got drafted by a really competitive team in the Minnesota Timberwolves. They already have significant depth at the guard position. Like, Mike Conley has actually been improved as of late, which you don't often see with an older guard playing better the second half of the year than what we saw early in the year. They have Dante DiVincenzo. They obviously have Anthony Edwards. And frankly, Rob Dillingham is an instant offense type of guy. Again, he's a smaller guard in year one. I think if you give him time to develop, he can be really special. He has flashed in limited minutes, a lot of those coming in garbage time. On the season, he is only averaging 5 points a game, 1 rebound and 2 assists across 46 appearances. But the three ball, he's shooting at a decent clip, 34%. I think Rob Dillingham would be much better in year two. And I think if you gave him more of a leash in year one, if he went to a less competitive team, you could have seen a lot more from him. Moving on to pick number 12. In real life, this went to the Thunder. They took Nikola Topic, who obviously has been injured all year long, hasn't played at all for the Oklahoma City Thunder. He will be back at some point next year. In this exercise, I'm going to have Kyle Filipowski at pick 12. I don't want to fall victim to what I did last year, taking Keontae George at like the third overall pick. I think I got a little crazy there. I have to know to take the stats and the production coming out of a bottom feeder team like Utah with a grain of salt. But that being said, I do think that Kyle Filipowski has been one of the most impressive rookie big men in his class, with his ability to immediately step in, shoot the ball at a high level, rebound the ball at a high level. I'm impressed, right? The dude's standing at basically 7 feet tall in 66 appearances. He's averaging 9 points a game, 6 rebounds, 2 assists, 52% from the field, 38% from three. I mean, I know the Jazz have not been competitive as of late, but he's been filling in a lot in the starting lineup for Lauri Markkanen, for Walker Kessler. And I think when he's given that opportunity, he's shined quite a bit, at least on the offensive end of the court. Defensively, granted, he's probably a mess like most rookies are, especially bigs in the NBA, but I think the guy has real talent, a real ability to shoot the ball. He was an impressive prospect coming out of Duke. I think the reason he fell to the second round was for like weird off the court stuff that I'm not going to get into at this point in time. But overall, it looks like the Jazz got a lot of great value there. And it might be surprising to some that Isaiah Collier has been impressive for the Jazz all year long. He's been putting up some pretty crazy assist numbers, but I just think that Filipowski is a more valuable rookie prospect for the Jazz this year. Moving on to pick 13 in real life, this went to the Kings and they took Devin Carter out of Providence. In this exercise, this is finally where I have Donovan Clingan being drafted at the 13th overall pick. I've actually watched a good amount of Clingan and I have not been impressed. I think I was expecting a little bit more fluidity as an athlete. I think I was expecting a little bit more upside on the defensive end right away. But frankly, he just looks like Luke Kornet like 3 years ago when the Celtics first got him. Just really awkward moving around. Like offensively, there's virtually nothing there. I guess he is shooting the three ball a little bit. Like he has a willingness to take open threes and he is shooting 31% from three, but he's been starting for a while now for the Trailblazers, and at this point, I expect him to start the remainder of the year. DeAndre Ayton's been out with a calf injury. Obviously, Rob Williams got shut down a while ago and barely played before that. So suddenly, there was a logjam at the center position to start the year for the Blazers, and now Klingon's been like the only true center on that roster. And I just would have liked to see a little bit more from him, right? I think Portland's been pretty competitive, so maybe you're asking too much, but it just doesn't look like he has the foot speed to do anything on the perimeter. Obviously, inside, he's still a presence, and on the inside on offense, he can still get some rebounds and clean up, but even his touch around the basket, I just don't see it. I'm not sure how he is anything more than like kind of like a gadget player on a competitive team down the road. Maybe I'm wrong. There was a reason this guy had some buzz to be the number one overall pick in the draft, but I just haven't been impressed with what I've seen. I still think he would need to be taken in the lottery, though. And then finally, with the final pick in this exercise, the final pick in the lottery, the 14th pick, originally this went to the Wizards. They took Bub Carrington here. I'm actually going to go out on a limb and go with Terrence Shannon Jr. of the Minnesota Timberwolves. This definitely could be considered a wild pick. Like, this guy's only appeared in 31 games, but for those that don't know anything about Terrence Shannon, and I barely know anything about Terrence Shannon, he was a really highly rated prospect, not just coming out of high school, but coming out of Texas Tech as well. I believe he had some interesting off-the-court issues as well that made him fall in the NBA draft too late in the first round where the Timberwolves were able to scoop him up. But there was a stretch in the season where he was playing consistent minutes for the Wolves. They were down a couple guys, Dante DiVincenzo included. And when he played, he was just so relentless getting to the basket. Like, this guy was getting to the cup on anybody. Ironically enough, I think the Timberwolves' best win of the season came in Oklahoma City about a month ago at this point in time, and it was a really weird game where Finch was getting into it with Anthony Edwards, and Anthony Edwards actually sat the bench for like the remainder of the fourth quarter, and the Wolves' like second unit led this like massive comeback, and the main proponent, the main engine behind that was Terrence Shannon Jr. And if you're going to use a small sample size, I guess you'd want to do it against, if you look at the advanced analytics, one of the best defenses ever with what OKC has going on right about now. And I just really liked his game. I thought he was really complete as a player athletically. It was really impressive for what he was able to do. He's listed at 6'6", but he looks a lot bigger than that. He's got a wide frame. He's super strong. And so I just feel like the upside that he flashed in those limited appearances, I can't have him outside the lottery. So even though he's only appeared in 31 games, he's been out recently with a groin injury. Again, he's on a very competitive Minnesota team. He is only averaging 5 points a game, 2 rebounds, 1 assist, but shooting 48% from the field and 36% from three. So I can't have Terrence Shannon Jr. outside of the lottery. So I'll run through the picks in just 1 second, but let me just go through some honorable mentions. Again, you could have made the argument for a bunch of different guys at the 14th overall pick. You could have argued it should have been Bub Carrington, the original selection there. He's had some moments for the Wizards. Also, Devin Carter. I really like some small sample size games that I've seen of Devin Carter. I weirdly watched like two of his best games of the year. I happened to be watching the Kings that night and was really impressed with what I've seen, but he hasn't been able to carve out consistent minutes. If you want to make arguments for Zach Edey, Yves Misi, Ryan Dunn, Keyshawn George, Isaiah Collier, Saloon from the Hornets, if anybody bothered to watch them and saw flashes in Saloon, let me know. But yeah, I think a lot of different guys you could make for honorable mentions for the last few spots. So just to recap, if I were to redo the 2024 NBA draft, this is what it would look like. At the first overall pick, I have Stephon Castle. Second overall pick, Zachary Risache. Third pick, Alex Sarr. Fourth pick, Matas Buzelis. Fifth pick, Khalil Ware. Pick number 6, Jared McCain. Number 7, Ron Holland. Number 8, Reed Shepard. Number 9, Jalen Wells. Number 10, Dalton Knecht. Number 11, Rob Dillingham. Number 12, Kyle Filipowski. Number 13, Donovan Klingon. Number 14, Terrence Shannon Jr. So admittedly, I feel way better about this exercise this year than I do last year. Maybe it's because I saw more of these rookies, maybe just watched more NBA as a whole. Maybe I got better at evaluating. Who knows? Last year was the first year I really had to take a close look at a rookie class over the span of a full season. And so we'll see which one of these guys flash in the final week or so of the regular season. some of these guys will have the opportunity to get playoff minutes, but we'll see. Definitely keep an eye on these rookies as we close the season. So before I let you guys go, just to give you an idea of what you can expect for next week. Again, I've been saying this forever, hoping to bring a guest on. Maybe we can focus on one of the top teams in the NBA or one of the more interesting teams as we head toward the playoffs. Also, because we are creeping up on the end of the regular season, I have to go through all of my end of season awards. So looking forward to that podcast, the playoff preview coming soon as well. And then finally, I am going to be in person for Luka's return to Dallas a week from today. So super fired up to see everything there. I'm super excited that Anthony Davis is back in the mix. Can't wait to watch him play. Hopefully we get like a fully healthy game. It's shaping up like that a week out. You never know what's going to happen between now and then, but it'd be really cool to see Luka, LeBron, Anthony Davis all taking the court at the same time. Interesting to see how the Mavericks, Nico Harrison, the new ownership, how they handle Luka's return, what that precious tribute video looks like, all that good stuff. So I'll be in person and we'll definitely report on that on my next podcast, unless I decide to record another episode before then. So with that, I will let you guys go. Be sure to follow at Words with Wallace on everything that includes Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, be sure to support the show on social media at Words with Wallace. Give me a follow on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, so you never miss any of the content or the reels that I upload. And I will talk to you guys next week. Peace.